Hi, and welcome back to This is True Crime, y'all. This is part two of Henry David Gaskins, also known as Pee-wee. Gaskins later called that first homicide his miracle, a beam of light like a vision. From that day on, he would troll the coastal highways in his spare time, finding victims and looking for future dump sites. By Christmas, he had committed two more of his coastal kills. It was recreational murder, refined over time, until he could keep his victims alive and screaming for hours on end, sometimes for days. In 1970, Gaskins would average one coastal kill every 6 weeks, experimenting with different torture methods, and disappointed when his victims died prematurely. "I preferred for them to last as long as possible," he wrote. The next year, he would claim 11 nameless victims, including his first kidnap slayings of two girls at one time. Ideas for tormenting his captives came to Gaskins as he browsed through hardware stores, eyeing the tools. Quote, "It got to be kind of a hobby, looking around whenever I was in a hardware store, figuring out how I might use tools and other stuff in different ways from what they was made for. I added things like hoses and a hand pump, a blowtorch, acids, lighters, hammers, hatchets, awls, and cables. There was never no doubt in my mind that I was going to do it again. Grant you, I dwelled on it some, because I knew that the law held murder seriouser than rape or burglaring or car stripping. But I figured it was worth the risk to rid myself of them spells of pain that had plagued me all my life. Some of them I cut, some of them I burned. I ran a cable in and out one. Oh, God. And hung her up by it. I pumped another one full of water, which seemed to really hurt, filling her up until it came out her nose and mouth. But she died quick, which I hadn't expected, so I didn't do that anymore. Once again, I preferred for them to last as long as possible." End quote. Gaskins' next victim was a woman named Daisy, whom he met in Myrtle Beach. He says that he did the exact same thing he had done during his first murder, but he learned to keep her alive for a longer period of time. After he was done torturing and raping her, he threw her body into the abyss of the swamp and used heavy chains to weigh her down. His next murder would be of his niece and her best friend. It was Tuesday, November 10th, 1970. Which apparently, when I Googled it, is rapper Warren G's birthday. No relation to this case at all, but I just thought I'd mention it. In his first confession, it was all complete bullshit and victim blaming and making him out to be some kind of hero after a tragic overdose. He said that Patricia and Janice ran away from home and he was sent to look for them. When he found them, they was both under drugs bad, and I started in on him about it, and we had a fight there, and I beat him to death with my fist and hands. In his book, The Final Truth, he would tell a different story entirely. He would say that the girls were drunk, and they had flagged him down, saying that they were too drunk to go home and needed to stay somewhere to sober up, which could take a while. The girl whose car they were in had to be home by 10, and it was already 5 after. So could her and Janice get in my car until Janice got straight? Then I could take them both home. Would I do that, Uncle Pee-wee? Please? I said, okay, sure. I would do what she asked. They climbed into the back seat. Then I took a long look at them two girls, and I got a different idea. I went into the restaurant and ordered us some coffee. Janice took a couple of sips and vomited all over the back seat, which upset Patricia Ann more than it did me. She apologized and said she would clean it up. I said I thought Janice needed a cold shower, and she could take one at my house. When Patricia Ann agreed, I knew she thought I was meaning at the mobile home where I lived in Sumter. She was too busy holding Janice's head while Janice puked to notice when we drove out of Sumter. Finally, Janice looked out the window and said, "Where are we going?" And I said I was going to my place in the country. Patricia hesitated a little when I stopped in front of that ramshackle tenant house, but she didn't say nothing else. She just helped me get Janice inside, into the bathroom that had a pipe stem shower over the tub. Pee-wee then began undressing his niece. And when Patricia said, "Let me do that," he said, "I'm her uncle. I've been bathing her all her life." The two bathed Janice and got soaking wet in the process. Pee-wee told the girls they could come into the bedroom and he would give them some clothes. He said they won't fit too well, but they'll do. Patricia helped Janice lie down on the bed and put a sheet over her. Then this disgusting human being took his pants off and shorts and showed Patricia Ann his erection. She took one look at this gross naked monster and ran for the door. But he drew his knife and pointed it at her and told her to sit on the bed. She started to say something, but he told her, "Be still and I won't hurt you." I was just aiming to teach Janice not to ever get so drunk again. Patricia sat as she was told to do. Oh God. While Pee-wee turned Janice on her back, propped her legs open, and laid on top of her. Janice sobered up real fast and started to fight. But very shortly, she felt the cold steel blade of a knife against her neck. Just as Pee-wee was about to commit the sexual assault on his niece, something hit him on the back of the head and everything went black. Pee-wee wakes up and both girls are gone. He pulls on his pants, grabs his pistol and flashlight, and runs after them. He chases them for a bit until he's close enough. He fires a shot into the air and yelled stop, and they did. Once they were back at the house, he got his duffel bag and went to the bedroom. I shoved them both towards the bed and told Patricia Ann to take off her clothes. She said no, so I backhanded her across the face with the pistol barrel. Her glasses went flying across the room and blood came pouring out of her nose. She fell onto the bed, holding her face and crying. He then told her to shut the fuck up and take off her clothes or she was going to be shot. As he was watching her undress, Janice made a mad dash for the door. He caught her just as she had flung it open. He smacked her on the side of the head with the butt of his gun, and she dropped to the floor. When he turned back around, Patricia Ann was headed at him with a piece of 2x4. Unfortunately, when she swung, Gaskins jumped out of the way. He grabbed her hair and put the pistol against her nose that was still bleeding and marched her back to the bedroom and handcuffed her. Then he went back and handcuffed Janice, who he says wasn't breathing too good. Every few seconds, her body jerked and twitched like she was having some kind of convulsion. He put the pistol down on the floor, picked her up, and carried to the bed as well. Then he stripped off Patty Ann's clothes, and even though she was handcuffed, she fought him tooth and nail, kicking, bucking, struggling to get up. These girls were fighters. So with one girl unconscious and the other fighting him, he picked up the pistol and hit her square on top of the head. Now he had two naked teenage girls unconscious on his bed. He could do whatever he wanted to them. By the time he was done, it was barely midnight. Janice was already almost dead, and he couldn't get any reaction from Patricia Ann. He said her friends called her Patty, but he was never her friend. He left Janice on the bed and carried Patricia Ann to the trunk of his car. He drove to a house that he knew was vacant and had a big septic tank. He took her body from the car to the tank and put her down. He opened the cement slab cover. He planned to crack her skull open to make sure she was dead, but decided that would be too big of a mess. So he just lowered her into the sludge and waited until there were no more bubbles. Then he pushed the cement lid back in place and went back for his knees. When he got back to the tenant house, Janice was definitely dead. He carried her out behind the barn and dug a shallow grave. He smoothed the ground and the next day bought a load of pine needles and scattered them to cover the fresh dug earth. Pee-wee was immediately questioned. Everyone had seen him with the girls. He admitted to the family and to the police that the girls had gotten in his car and they had gone to the drive-in. He said that while he was there, Janice asked him about some family they had in California, saying that her and Patty were both unhappy and were going to run away. He then said the two girls got out of his car and into another car with some boys they knew. The families and friends did not believe him, but there was no evidence to say that he had anything to do with their disappearances. Pee-wee's next victim was Martha Dix, who you will recall is the woman that he blamed for the girls' murders, saying that she had given the girls drugs and then he had to beat them to death, because that makes sense. Now, what actually happened with Martha Dix was that she had a little bit of a crush on Pee-wee. She was a young African-American woman who dressed in men's clothing and liked to go by the name Clyde. She hung around the garage he frequented, and she became infatuated with him. She used to say that they were lovers. One day, she went too far and claimed to be pregnant with his child. He invited her over after work, crushed pills into a drink, and when she died in his house, he threw her body in a ditch. In one of his ever-changing stories, he would say, quote, "I didn't kill her for no reason besides her lying mouth," end quote. Gaskin's next crime would be very high profile. She was a young 13-year-old girl named Margaret Catino, but she went by Peggy. Peggy got out of school and told her mother she was going to have lunch with her younger sister at Willow Drive Elementary. 2 hours went by, and her mother became increasingly worried. This was not like Peggy. The police and her father were called, and a search for the missing girl started immediately. Her father was Senator James Catino, and her grandfather at the time was president of Clemson University. Her photo and description hit the headlines, and everyone was on the lookout for the 5'2", 120-pound, 13-year-old with shoulder-length brown hair, last seen wearing a polka-dot shirt and white skirt. Police put together a timeline that showed that she made it to the YMCA next to the school, which was closed under construction, but no further. Gaskins was questioned along with the other construction workers, but he had a rock-solid alibi and was released. Men at the job site did confirm he worked the entire day. On December 30th, 12 days after the girl disappeared, two young men walking near the Manchester Woods spotted what they thought was a mannequin. "Guys, we all know it's never a mannequin. And this is so sad, because they thought that until they saw her clothing, which had been highly publicized, and the polka dot shirt and white skirt immediately set off alarm bells." Her autopsy showed blunt force trauma to the head. She had cigarette burns, what they thought were cigarette burns, all over her body, and she had died due to strangulation. She had been raped and sodomized and kept alive for a couple of days. Now, this was 1970, and apparently the detectives and coroner had different ideas on her time of death. The coroner concluded she had been killed only 5 days prior to her body being found. There was semen on her body, and it had not degraded as much as it would have if it would have been left on the day that her body was discovered. The detectives believed she had definitely been kidnapped and murdered on the same day because it fit their number one suspect. After police had released Pee Wee Gaskins, they set their sights on a Swainsboro, Georgia resident named William Jr. Pierce. Pierce, who barely had an IQ of 70, was detained for her murder. Pierce was known to confess to crimes that he didn't commit. In this case, though, the defense would argue that Sheriff Red Carter had tortured a confession out of him. They would even submit physicians' reports showing him beaten, bloodied, bruised, burned, and that he had cuts made to his genitalia while in police custody. He had a rock-solid alibi. He clocked into work that morning over 200 miles away, and his boss reported seeing him almost every hour thereafter, making it impossible for him to drive the over 400 miles round trip to commit the crime. The police and prosecution had set their sights on Pierce, and they were going to get a conviction. The case was full of holes. There was no physical evidence. There was a coerced confession. The defense lawyer, who wasn't even wet behind the ears, was taking on a highly publicized murder case. He seldom challenged the prosecution, and the only thing he presented was the time card his client punched in and out of work that day. Pierce was convicted after the jury deliberated for 6 hours, after a 16-hour murder trial. 16 hours to present all of the evidence to a jury in a highly publicized murder trial, and then a conviction after the jury deliberates for 6 hours and sentences a man to life in prison is pretty wild to me. Gaskins would say that Peggy disrespected him. She was walking by him and, quote, "I said, 'Hello, Peggy,' and I smiled real polite, and she stuck her nose up in the air like she smelled something and turned on her heels and didn't speak to me. And when they was walking away, I heard one of her friends say, 'Who was that?' And Peggy said, 'Just white trash, can't you tell?'" End quote. And that was when he decided the next opportunity she would become his victim. He did a lot of terrible things to her in his barn, where he duct taped her mouth and handcuffed her to a table. He also said this: "Proof that what I say here is true, don't take but a few words." Reports before and during Junior Pierce's trial said that Peggy Catino's body was covered with cigarette torture burns. But no more details were ever made known. Like I said, the official report weren't never released for the family's sake. So it's logical to say the onlyest person outside of the coroner and court officials who knows the truth about them burns is the one who did the torture and murder. And that weren't Junior Pierce. And them burns weren't made with no cigarettes. I poured acid on her, one trickle at a time. Gaskins went on with his life like nothing had happened, marrying wife number 5, who was pregnant on New Year's Eve. We're going to leave this kid's name out, although it is widely publicized. I would hate to be known as this man's progeny. So he did what Pee-wee does and goes back to stripping stolen cars and cruising the coastal highways looking for more victims. In June of 1972, Annie Culberson from Atlanta was his next victim. He smashed her head in with a hammer, dug a shallow grave, and buried her. But only after he had held and tortured her for 96 hours. He did the same thing with his next victim, 19-year-old Jackie Freeman, who was beaten, raped, and tortured for days. When he was done, he cut off a chunk of her calf muscle, cooked, and ate it. And this next one is really going to hurt. I mean, this next, they're all fucking terrible, let's be honest. But the next one is horrific. So, you know, grab a drink, grab a smoke, and prepare yourself for the monster that Gaskins truly is. Gaskins had known Doreen Dempsey for some time. She was unwed, down on her luck, and currently 8 months pregnant, and had a 2-year-old daughter named Robin. She was looking for a ride to the bus station to get out of town so that she could be with her family when her baby was born. According to Gaskins, he offered to take her, but with payment of sex. She allegedly agreed. Gaskins, being the scumbag that he is, then asked if he could have sex with her 2-year-old child. Fucking gross. She refused. He got angry. He killed her and her child and dumped the bodies. But wait, there's more, because he can't stop talking. He can't keep his story straight, and he can't stop making shit up to make his victims look bad. His second, an extremely disgusting racist version of what happened, was that he had helped Dempsey before, and she showed up to his house asking if she could stay there again. By this time, Gaskin said she was asking too much because he knew the father of her daughter was black. Dempsey was white. Gaskins would later explain why he killed them both. Quote, "When you go mixing, I don't hold with that one bit in the world," end quote. He also said that her friends had dropped her off. While they waited in the car with the 2-year-old, Gaskins took Dempsey behind the house. "I was going to talk with her, and she was about 7 or 8 months pregnant at the time. So I asked her who the daddy of the kid was. She was carrying right then, and it was another black kid from what she told me. We went on around to the fish pond, and we walked around by the edge, and I just shoved her right in the pond and grabbed her by the feet and held her under. He then went and got the toddler from the car, saying they could stay with him, and went and drowned the child the same way as the mother. The baby had a crushed skull, which Gaskins swears he is not responsible for, but we all know that he is a goddamn liar. What we do know happened, and this is a fact, this isn't him making things up, he raped Doreen, strangled her, and then had sex with her corpse. Then, brace yourselves, oh God, he raped and sodomized her 2-year-old daughter. It literally makes me want to throw up saying that. Because he says, fucking quote, "It was the best sex of my life," end quote. Gaskins starts to escalate after this. Is cooling off, if you can say escalate, I mean, he's already going bananas with it. His cooling off periods in between murders get shorter and shorter, and he starts to get very sloppy. In July, he would kill his first male victims, who were acquired by accident. He mistakenly took them for girls because they had long hair when he pulled up behind them. Gender would not save them, though. He drove them both to the hideout, where he sodomized and tortured them, cooking and cannibalizing their severed genitals before he granted them the mercy of death. Later that same month, he would kidnap Johnny Sellers, 36, and Jesse Ruth Judy, age 22. Gaskin said that Sellers owed him money for bailing him out of jail. When he got out, he wouldn't pay up. So he invited Johnny and his girlfriend, Jessie, to see some stolen goods he wanted to get rid of. While Jessie sat in the car, Gaskins and Johnny went into the woods to take a gander at his cache of stolen, non-existent things. Here's what Gaskins had to say about the murder, quote, "Me and Johnny walked around there in the woods, and I pretended I seen a snake. And I asked Johnny, did he have his gun with him? So Johnny says, I ain't got no bullets for my gun. I went back to my car, got my gun, and shot Johnny in the woods. He left Sellers lying in the woods and went back to get Judy. I told Jessie that Johnny said for her to come with me. So I carried her back there and killed her, and then I buried him. He went as far as to tell Judy he was going to kill her, but she didn't say anything about it because he had told her that hundreds of times before. He said he felt bad about that murder because he and Judy had previously had sex, but he knew she'd be pissed that he killed Johnny. But really, that was all bullshit. He just needed more people to rape and torture to satisfy the voice inside of his head. And that's exactly what he did with them. Johnny and Jessie were tortured and sodomized. He did not kill them right away, though. Instead, while they were still alive, he bound them with weights and heavy chains and dropped them in a nearby river. He even stayed to watch them struggle to get out of their chains and escape their cold, dark, watery grave. In August, he kills 40-year-old Horace Jones. There's little information about this crime, but the rest of the year is filled with his incessant voice nagging him to murder people. He ignores it while dealing with his divorce from wife number 5. I mean, who's counting? I mean, I'm obviously counting, but I think it's number 5. Jeez, it feels like it's been more. Gaskins moves out of the family home and into a shack with ex-con Walter Neely. His next victims were two white carnival workers. He said were named Linda and Jeanette. He and 3 other men decided to kill them because they heard the women only dated black men. He said he shot both in the head at the Isle of Palms. Their bodies have never been recovered. So who knows if he's telling the truth or this is just some more racist bullshit. Gaskins is once again cruising for victims on Highway 17 when he comes upon a broken-down van carrying 2 college-age women and a man. Instead of helping, because he's not a helper, he decides he's going to make them have an orgy for his pleasure. He makes the women perform sexual acts on each other and tries to force the man to rape the women. When he can't perform, Gaskins castrates him. Gaskins then rapes the women and murders the trio. However, this was too many victims for him to clean up on his own. He gets good old ex-con and roommate Walter Neely to come with him to drive the van containing the bodies to his garage and even convinces Neely to help him dump them. Later that year, he was hired to kill Silas Yates for $1,500. Yes, in case you didn't know, he also kills people for money. Again, $1,500, that was his fee for the murder of Silas Yates. In today's money, that would be $8,275. Silas was a wealthy farmer who had pissed off his ex-girlfriend and mistress to the point that she wanted him dead. She contacted John Powell and John Owens, who are a bunch of ex-cons as well, who spoke with Gaskins to get the job done. On February 12, 1975, they lured Silas out of his house with claims that a woman, Diane Neely, Walter's wife, was in distress. Gaskins snuck up on Silas, hit him over the head, and kidnapped him. Later, he would be murdered in front of the 2 people who helped set up the hit, Owens and Powell. He was buried in Pee-wee's personal graveyard. Diane Neely opened her big mouth to her boyfriend. And I know what you're thinking. Didn't I just say that she was Walter Neely's wife? Well, she was. But she also had a boyfriend, another ex-con, named Avery Howard. Now, Walter didn't know about the boyfriend and thought that Avery was just very good friends with her. Gaskins, however, knew better because he often let the two have sex in his garage. Diane and Avery decided it was a good idea to blackmail Gaskins for $5,000. Boy, were they wrong. He told them he would agree to the $5,000 payment. They set up a meeting, and when they got there, they were both stabbed and shot in the head. In September 1975, Pee-wee was once again on the lookout, but this time his victim and his target was a local 13-year-old girl named Kim Gelkins. She knew Gaskins from the neighborhood and was lured into his house, where he raped and murdered her. Gaskins, of course, had a completely different fabricated story. He says that Gelkins had accused him and other men from the neighborhood of raping her. They probably did. He had two friends lure her to a dirt road where he shot her in the back of the head and then stabbed her in the abdomen for telling lies about him and the other men. When asked why he did both, Gaskins answered, "Well, I had my knife with me too." Now, in October of 1975, two local yokels, Johnny Knight and Dennis Bellamy, rob Gaskins' garage blind, steal all of his stolen cars. I mean, how dare they steal something he had rightfully stolen? That's just rude. Word quickly gets around, like it does in a small town, and Gaskins disposes of the pair and gets his bestie, Walter, to help him dispose of the bodies. God, this guy is an amazing friend. Anyway, now there's the actual account of what happened, because police say these two guys were actually looking for their sister and half-sister, Diane, who he murdered and who had been missing. Gaskins apparently tries to befriend them because he says he liked the Knight youth, but he detested Bellamy. They'd feuded since 1971 when Bellamy got drunk and started a fight at Gaskins' house. I didn't allow people to come to my house drunk around the children. Okay, you shouldn't be around children, period. And you're worried about people having some drinks around them? What? Excuse me, sir? You're a monster. Anyway, he claims that the night he killed Bellamy, that Bellamy was drunk again and staggered into a mud hole into the yard. I said to myself, you made a mistake coming here tonight. Gaskins said he offered Bellamy a ride in a hot car he'd just stolen. He stopped in the woods, saying he had to relieve himself. Bellamy went with him, and then he shot him 3 times in the head. I said if I ever had the chance to kill him, I'd kill him, and I got the chance, and I killed him, Gaskins said. Gaskins went back and got Johnny Knight, walked him down to the woods, almost the same place that he had shot his friend. I pulled my gun out and shot him, and that was all there was to it. I killed him because I done killed his brother. Now you've killed, like, how many members of this family? And this, my lovers of true crime, is where we're going to end it for today. This is my first three-parter. Tomorrow, the next part will drop. It will probably be short, but there will be some things you haven't heard in there. So please stick with me and tune in. And do not forget to hit the like button, give me 5 stars on your favorite app, and let me know what you think of the pod. Thanks so much for listening. I'll talk to you tomorrow.